healthcare costs were going at 3.4%, it frees up massive amounts of money for reinvestment in human resources and plant and equipment. So this is a huge success story, and we're leading the nation here in redefining and changing our model for delivering healthcare. Very exciting.
Governor Kitzhaber, thank you. Would you like 30 seconds to respond, Representative Richardson?
Yes, just to continue this joint discussion, because we're in agreement on how we can approach this. We need to ensure that the community care model does what it's intended to do, and that is not just how you spend money differently and act like a managed care organization, but actually work with individuals, help them to see the importance of changing lifestyles. And I mean, if we can help people lessen their smoking, and lessen their the obesity problems, lessen their dependence on drugs, we can help them not only have a better life, but also have lower expenses that will help the whole system.
Thank you. It's refreshing to see some agreement here during campaign season. Governor Kitzhaber, we'll start with you on this next question. Senator Ron Wyden has sponsored a bill to double the timber harvest on ONC forest land in Oregon. Some groups would say it will allow too much logging. Others will say not enough. Where do you stand?
Well, probably right in between them. I mean, everyone's going to be upset with this bill. I had a conference call with the senator and Representative Fazio last week. We're getting a new bill draft this week, and we propose to meet again the week after that. There is a pathway here to allow responsible increase in harvest on those ONC lands that still provides a significant conservation lift. It's not impossible. The issues really are not the board fee as much to me as the certainty that whatever board foot level is arrived at, you can count on, and that we then bring some revenue into the counties that they can also count on. So, you know, this isn't about gutting the Endangered Species Act. This isn't about rolling back environmental laws. It's stepping back and asking ourselves, can't we do a better job finding a pathway to get more value off of that specific 2 million acres of land in southwest Oregon that certainly needs it, and manage that in a way that dramatically improves the conservation value and gain that we can get from those resources.
Governor, thank you. Representative Richardson, this again about Senator Ron Wyden's bill to double the timber harvest on ONC forest land in Oregon. Where do you stand as far as it being enough or too much harvest in our forest land?
I think the bill is flawed because, once again, it does not give the certainty that the timber industry needs. We've lost over 100 mills in recent decades. And what do we have to show for it? Promises, discussion, and occasionally payments from the federal government. What we need is to be able to count on there being certain timber that can be utilized by our mills. Oregon is a natural resource-based state, and yet in our rural communities especially, we have them languishing in depression because they can't utilize the timber. What we need is a governor who will be back in Washington, D.C., who will lead a delegation of other Western governors and bring our case to not only the Congress and the President, but to national media to show that we cannot allow citizens, Americans in Oregon, to be languishing in poverty and in depression when our other Americans don't even know about it in the East. We're all Americans. We need a governor who will bring this to the people and not settle for just more talk by senators or by our representatives.
Representative, thank you. Governor Kitzhaber, 30 seconds to respond.
Yeah, actually, we're doing a lot of those things. In Eastern Oregon, the Blue Mountain Partnership is a 10-year stewardship agreement and timber supply that has kept the last mill in John Day open and adding jobs, and has fed the mill, the Boise Cascade Mill in LeGrand, which is actually adding jobs. So the point is, there are creative things we can do to find that middle ground that improves the economy, improves the health of the forest, and keeps people back to work in the woods. We've done it in Eastern Oregon. We saved the last mill in your district, Rough and Ready, by finding a creative way to get a timber supply, and we're going to continue to lean on that issue, and we're going to make it work.
Governor, thank you. Representative Richardson, should undocumented immigrants have driving privileges in Oregon as allowed under ballot measure 88, and why?
This is a very sensitive question because it affects lives. And the decisions that are made on this, you know, it really does have an impact on families and their abilities to attend things, you know, to have transportation. So I take it very seriously. I think it's a mistake, though, for us to grant those driving privileges because we can learn from the experiences of other jurisdictions. Tennessee had this kind of a program, and they repealed it because they had busloads of illegal residents, immigrants that were coming to Tennessee so that they could get that government card. In New Mexico, The governor, Susana Martinez, has said if she had the power to repeal it in New Mexico, she would repeal it for the same reason, that they have a certain number of immigrants in their boundaries of their state, but they've issued cards that are much more than the number that they have in the state. We need to learn from the experience of others. Driving is not a right. It's a privilege. I mean, I've got a bunch of teenagers. I understand that it is a privilege and not a right.
Thank you. Governor Kitzhaber, I'll repeat the question. Should undocumented immigrants have driving privileges in Oregon as allowed under ballot measure 88, and why?
Absolutely, yes. First of all, it reduces the number of uninsured and unlicensed people on the road, so there's a safety issue here. But this is part of a much larger commitment to equity and opportunity in this state. These people are working in Oregon. They're paying taxes in Oregon. They're the backbone of our nursery industry. They're the backbone of a huge part of our agricultural industry. They're contributing to the state. They're hard workers. They deserve the right to be able to legally drive to and from work, to and from church, take their kids to school. If this is a nation that believes in equity and opportunity, that we were all created equal, that we all have certain rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, then surely the pursuit of happiness must include the ability to drive to work and to take care of your family. So to me, this is an issue of fundamental equity and equality, and I believe very deeply that we should allow these individuals to be able to drive.
Governor, thank you. Representative Richardson, you have 30 seconds to respond.
Well, I appreciate the governor's passion, but the Declaration of Independence was not dealing with illegal immigrants that are in our state and are here breaking the law. This is not an easy discussion. This is not an easy issue. But ultimately, you have to have certain principles. Either we enforce the law and we live with the law, or we make special exceptions for special people. We've got a problem. It's the federal government's problem, and that is on the border. But we have to live with what we have here. We have to make a decision. Do we allow people to have special rights merely because our hearts reach out to them, or do we have a law where we enforce the laws for everyone? That's where we're at, and I believe that that's where we need to remain.
Representative, thank you. Governor, we'll start with you on this question. Should Oregon employers provide paid sick leave to all workers, including part-time employees? Why or why not?
I also believe in a paid sick leave policy. It needs to be a statewide policy, not a city or county, but county policy. And obviously, it has to work for small businesses, and we have to make sure that it doesn't result in other benefits simply being dropped. But the fact of the matter is, if you are a low-income worker in this state, you have absolutely no margin. If you have to leave to go to the doctor, if you get sick, let's say they're on minimum wage, our great minimum wage, they're making $18,000, $19,000 a year, and they get sick. That can devastate them. If they're working at a fast food restaurant, they can lose their job. What happens then? Well, they come on to the state welfare system and get public support. So it's a system that doesn't make any sense. Paid sick leave is a rational human response to how we support people in our labor force, particularly people at the low end trying to move up.
Governor, thank you. Representative Richardson, should Oregon employers provide paid sick leave to all workers, including part-time employees? Why or why not?
Yes, I believe they should. But the difference between our viewpoint is I don't believe it's the government's place to make a mandate to pass a law and to punish people with the threat of either confiscation or imprisonment for not keeping a law as determined by the government. I think that it's what employers should do. I did that as an employer myself, and I've done that for years in various businesses in which I've been involved. I think it's an important thing for us to do. I think there needs to be training. There needs to be publicity about it, but that we cross the line when we say the government is going to pass a law and threaten people if they don't comply with the way that the government thinks something ought to be done.
Governor, 30-second response.
Pass.
We'll pass on that one. Okay. Representative Richardson, this one starts with you. What is the state's role when counties or school districts, for example, are unable or unwilling to fund things that are mandated by the state legislature?
It's a huge problem. I mean, one of the reasons that I ran for the House was I was on a city council, and I talked to the other city council members because we kept getting mandates from the state on what to do with the building department, and they would tell us how to be better, but they wouldn't give us the money to do it. I think it's a huge mistake for us to allow the government at any level to give mandates and not show how it's going to be funded. I believe that the government, especially the state government, should be a resource to local and county government and not a dictator. I think that we have room to improve in that, and that we should ensure that we're not giving mandates that they can't afford to enforce.
Governor Kitzhaber, I'll repeat that for you. What is the state's role when counties or school districts are unable or unwilling to fund things that are mandated by the state legislature?
I think there's two parts to the answer. First is unable. I do agree with Representative Richardson that we need to be very careful about mandating things on other segments of a government that clearly they can't pay for. It doesn't make a lot of sense. So we need to look at that and continue to look at that. I think the larger question is when people are unwilling. And what we have in parts of Southern Ring right now is a true public safety crisis where one of the lowest property tax rates in the state, people are unwilling to raise those rates to fund basic law enforcement. There is really no law enforcement in Josephine County anymore. It's a very, very dangerous situation. We've passed legislation to try to address that, where that we can levy some increase matched by the legislature should the county commission request it of the legislature. That hasn't happened yet. Our options are basically to send the state police in, but at some point you have to ask, should the rest of the state be essentially supporting the public safety services for counties that are simply unwilling to pay for it themselves? There's no easy answer to this one, but this is going to not just affect that county. It's coming to Lane County. It's coming to Curry County. It's coming to Coos County. And it's an issue we have to take very seriously and try to address.
Governor, thank you. Representative Richardson, 30 seconds to respond.
The reason that counties are not able to pay the expenses of law enforcement, such as in Josephine County, it goes back to our policy on timber. You have a county that has some 60% of its land controlled in timber, and they can't cut. They can't develop their economy. They don't have the clusters that we have up in the northern part of the state. So what we really need to do is to ensure that they have the resources, the income, the revenue, the economy that will allow them to make the payments that are necessary.
Representative, thank you. Governor, I do want to ask a quick question to clarify. You said it is not an easy topic to tackle and not an easy decision to make, but do you feel it's appropriate for the state to send state police to start policing these areas when communities are unwilling to fund it themselves?
Well, we're already doing it. So the short answer is yes, but the state police is underfunded, under-budgeted, and they're stretched, right? So that's not a long-term solution unless the legislature is willing to really pump up the funding for state police. So I think if we're going to have counties, if you're going to be a county, there are certain basic services that the county needs to be able to provide. And state police is a short-term stopgap measure, but it is not the long-term answer.
All right, Governor, thank you. The next question does begin with you. What would a good transportation package contain for the next biennium? Assuming it contains a revenue component, where would you propose that revenue comes from?
Well, in the short term, I think the most likely revenue would be some kind of a gas tax increase, and I know the Transportation Coalition is looking at that. Unfortunately, that's not a long-term solution because the gas tax is bringing in less and less money as people drive less, as their vehicles are more efficient. So we need to look at a long-term answer, and I'll give you two options. We have a vehicle miles traveled pilot out there to sort of change the way we finance transportation that would capture electric vehicles and alternative fuel vehicles, which I think are going to be coming. But we need to figure out a way, in my estimation, to figure out how to attract private institutional capital to finance public infrastructure projects. We have something called the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange, which is a Oregon, Washington, California, British Columbia partnership to try to do just that. I think that the model is called Partnerships BC in Canada. They've done, I think, $10 billion of public infrastructure projects financed with private resources. So that is probably the most fruitful avenue because we can't count on the federal government to even finance the basic highway and service highway trust fund.
Governor, thank you. Representative Richardson, what would a good transportation package contain for the next biennium? Assuming it contains a revenue component, where would you propose that revenue comes from?
Infrastructure and transportation is a basic requirement of government. I mean, for instance, we need a bridge, and we have a 100-year-old bridge going across the Columbia River, and we need to have that be a priority where the legislators and the governors work together to come up with a system that's going to be able to have a project that will create a bridge and not just ensure that cronies get paid their money and that millions of dollars get wasted. We need to also focus on what are called statewide transportation improvement packages. Every region of the state has their own priorities. They need to have the funding. They need to use. They need to have the ability to have their projects funded as well. How do you do that? It's a combination of focusing on high priorities for infrastructure projects, not have them get whatever's left, and utilizing debt in a rational way, because when you're fixing a bridge, it's a long-term project. It's a capital improvement, and you need to be able to fund that sometimes using debt.
Representative, thank you. Governor, you have 30 seconds to respond.
Yeah, just one thing. I do think that by changing the contracting model, which is really what we're talking about here, you can bring these institutional dollars in. So to build a bridge right now, it's a design-build contract, right? So you get the lowest bidder. We're talking about moving to a design-build, maintain, and operate over a 30-year period, which gets you a fundamentally different kind of contract. And we have over a trillion-dollar infrastructure hole along the West Coast, and we're not going to fill it unless we somehow figure out how to really aggressively create that public-private partnership and bring those dollars to bear on public infrastructure projects. It's critical to the public sector, critical to the economy.
And it requires tolling, by the way.
And it probably requires tolling.
Thank you both for the additional comments there. Representative Richardson, the next question will go to you. What ideas would you propose to assist the economic recovery in the rural counties of Oregon that are well behind in our recovery process?
It's vitally important that a governor be the ambassador for Oregon businesses. We can't just focus on Washington County and the great success they're having there. Every area of this state has attributes. Look at the aviation industry here in eastern Oregon, manned and unmanned. But it's not enough merely to have great products. You need to be able to sell those. And so a governor should be the ambassador for the aviation industry of eastern Oregon. I've organized 10 trade missions to China as a legislator. I took legislators and businesses, and we went there to help consumers in China understand that Oregon is in business and we have things that they want to buy. As a result, we brought back contracts for over $1 million that have helped companies to expand and develop. What we need to do in rural Oregon, not only deal with our natural resources, but also make sure that our products are expanded and sold internationally.
Representative, thank you. I'll repeat the question, Governor. Mm-hmm. What ideas would you propose to assist the economic recovery in the rural counties of Oregon that are well behind in the recovery process?
You know, it's been said if you've seen one Oregon county, you've seen one Oregon county. And we actually don't have a singular economy. We have a whole host of regional economies, which is why we set up the regional solutions process. We have groups in every county, including this one, that essentially prioritize community and economic development processes. And then we bring to bear state, federal, local, not-for-profit resources. We have a four-year institution coming right here as a result of a regional solutions process. The Blue Mountain Timber Project I mentioned on the east side is another example of that. So we have producing tangible results right now all across counties. We need to remember, however, that the commonality is trying to build on our natural resource infrastructure, which means investing in innovation and research for the natural resource economy. For example, marrying the Department of Forestry at OSU with the Department of Architecture at U of O to figure out how to innovate and create multi-story wood buildings and other ways to utilize this wonderful renewable resource that we have in abundance up here in the state of Oregon.
Governor, thank you. Representative, 30-second response.
If we want to bring in new money into our economies, especially into rural Oregon, then we need to be able to sell their projects. And so as far as a specific thing that could be done, out of my office budget as governor, I will establish a lieutenant governor's position whose focus will be solely on international trade, developing the relationships that we need. Oregon is a gateway to the universe, right? I mean, gateway to the world. And we can sell our products if we have somebody that's working to do that and has actually established offices in our various countries where we have our greatest opportunities for export.
Representative, thank you. I must compliment both of you for staying so well on time on all of these questions. Still, we have reached the point where we are at our final question of this debate, and Governor, it begins with you. What are the first three things you will accomplish as governor that will impact the voters of Oregon on a personal level?
I will continue to expand the access to quality, affordable health care to Oregonians, which will impact them on a very personal level. Secondly, we will continue to lean into our early learning delivery system, which is going to have a huge impact on children and families before they ever get to school. Third, I'm going to implement the low-carbon fuel standard, which is going to create jobs and economic activity around the state of Oregon and begin to diversify our transportation fuel opportunities, which will, I think, bring thousands of new jobs to the state of Oregon, reduce the export of billions of dollars that we send outside the state now to bring in fossil fuel, and create jobs and better economic opportunities for people.
Governor, thank you. Representative Richardson, what are the first three things you will accomplish as governor that will impact the voters on a personal level?
First, I'm going to implement pay equality. It's not something just to be discussed, but women deserve to be paid the same as men for the same experience. The governor's office, he pays 79 cents for women for every dollar he pays to men. That's wrong. First thing I'll do as governor is to make sure that my office sets an example with equal pay for equal work and equal experience for men and women. Secondly, focus on education. We cannot continue to have an education system where when our graduation rate is second to last in the country. That is unacceptable. We're losing a generation of our youth. And so I will focus not just on getting kids to go to college, because you have 100% of your effort focused on that and 25% of the kids actually go. We need to make sure we have mentors, we have technical and professional opportunities for kids. We're using the unions and trade sectors to help provide those kinds of training for those kids that aren't going to go to college. We need mentors. Every child deserves a mentor and an education and an opportunity for a future. And finally, we're going to restore trust in our state so that the people can trust their state government and we won't continue to lose so much money.
Representative, thank you. We're running a little over time here with this question. I do want to give the governor 30 seconds to respond to that.
Well, first of all, if the charge is that my office doesn't provide equal pay for equal work, it is categorically untrue. And even the reporter whose article you used to cook these numbers has repudiated the way you have done this. It just seems to me a little cynical that you would discover equity for women after an 11-year history in the legislature where very few of your votes actually suggest that you believe in that.
There you go again.
Thank you, Ronald.
Talking about the past.
Well, on that note, gentlemen, we're going to move on to our closing statements. By the flip of the coin, Representative Richardson, you will have the first closing statements. You have 3 minutes for it, sir.
Oregon is a wonderful state. I mean, consider for a moment you and your family. Take yourself back 170 years ago, and you want an opportunity, and you hear about Oregon, a place where there's tall timber and deep soil and lots of water and land, a place where you can plant your roots and provide a legacy for your kids and grandkids. We call these people pioneers, but if you were that family and you wanted that, and you put everything you had into a wagon and you rode on the side of it, Oregon or bust, and you start walking, 2,200 miles you walk. And why? Because you want an opportunity, a legacy of freedom for your family and for generations to come. That is what we inherited. We drink from wells we didn't dig. And yet, where are we now? We have high unemployment. We have low achievement in our schools. We have a distrust in our state and in our government. And what is the answer? It always seems to be eligibility and qualifications. We have put 300,000 more people onto health care. Well, we want everyone to have good health care, but it always seems to be subsidized health care. And then what happens when you can't get a doctor because now you've got a card, but you don't have the money to pay for your deductible, and your doctor can't treat you and give you a break on the price because he'd be breaking the law? We don't need the government to try and tell us how we should live our lives. If we want a legacy for our children, like we received from our parents and those that came before us, then we need to change the way we do business. We need to restore our state. We need to reboot our economy. We need to reform our education system so that our kids aren't next to last, but have a world-class education. That's what they deserve, and we can't afford to lose another generation. And we need to restore trust and confidence in state government. As governor, I will be a people's governor. I will reinstitute office hours. I will do what Senator Wyden is doing and go to every county, every state, every year, and have the opportunity for people all over the state to bring their questions to the governor. I want us to have a governor who will help restore confidence, look to the future, and not be focused on trying to make defenses for what's gone on in the past and hope that we can do better. I say to the governor, you've had 3 terms, governor, and in baseball, it's 3 strikes and you're out.
Representative, thank you. Governor Kitzhaber, 3 minutes for your closing remarks.
Let me start by saying this race is about two things. It's about values, and it's about the ability to deliver. And values matter, and my opponent and I differ fundamentally about the values that I think are important to this great state. We differ on the issue of a woman's fundamental right to control her own reproductive health choices. We differ on the right of Oregonians to marry the person that they love. We differ on the importance of embracing Oregon's growing diversity, whether that be through tuition equity or supporting immigrant children. And we disagree on the importance of maintaining Oregon's environment and natural wonder as the foundation of both our identity and of our economy. Our state is a vastly better place now than it was 4 years ago, and that's largely due to the fact that we did not allow the Great Recession or high unemployment or a divided legislature to tear us apart. It reflects a change in the tone at the top, and it reflects leadership that has fought for and delivered for Oregonians. We came together as Oregonians over the past 4 years and found common solutions to some very, very difficult issues. We erased our budget deficit and balanced the books with bipartisanship. We set out to create 25,000 new jobs each year, and we have exceeded that goal. We've secured huge capital investments in some of our major traded sector industries, from Intel to Daimler Trucks. We've created a four-year university right here in Central Oregon, brought two data centers to Prineville, and facilitated the expansion of the Central Oregon Truck Company. We've kept timber mills open in John Day, in Umatilla, and in rural Josephine County, and we're working together to bring more water for irrigated agriculture in the Umatilla Basin. Across this state, communities are coming together, working on outcomes for kids, on kindergarten readiness, on third grade reading. We added $1 billion to our K-12 school system in the last 4 years, and we have the first tuition freeze in 14 years. And today, 95% of all Oregonians have health insurance coverage. Tens of thousands of them, for the very first time, they don't have to choose between the utility bill and taking their child to the doctor. They are happier, they are healthier, they are more productive on the job. Together we have delivered for Oregon, but we still have some serious challenges. The economic recovery has left large portions of our state behind, communities of color, people in rural parts of our state. Meeting those challenges require two things. First, it requires leadership based on values and based on the belief that we are all in this together, based on the belief that Oregon won't be a good place for any of us to live unless it's a good place for all of us to live. And second, it requires the ability to bring people together to tackle these problems as a community. We have brought our state back together over the past 4 years, and together we have delivered for Oregon. We're well down the road to a much more prosperous future, and we cannot allow ourselves to return to the divisiveness of the past. This campaign is about two things. It's about values. It's about the ability to deliver. I'm John Kitzhaber, and I'm asking for your vote on November 4th.
Governor, thank you. This is a bit of a rarity in a debate. We actually have a little bit of extra time. So I'm going to ask you each one additional question. This is somewhat off the cuff, and we'll ask you to keep the less than 30 seconds. One of the OAB members suggested this to me yesterday. Representative Richardson, can you tell us one thing that you like about your opponent in this race?
The truth is we get along fine. This is competition. He wants a fourth term. I think I can do better. And so we'll both be glad when November 5th comes, regardless of the outcome. I think John's a very affable guy. You know, I mean, I think that Kulongowski had it wrong when he was asked what is the difference between you and Governor Kitzhaber, and he said, I like people. I mean, John seems like he likes people. He's a decent guy. It's not about personalities. It's about the ability to lead, and we have a different background and a different focus on what the future is for our state.
Representative, thank you. Governor Kitzhaber, one thing you like about your opponent
in
this race?
Yeah, we're past the debate, so I'm not going to debate anymore. Dennis and I, he was one of the first people walked across to his office when I was first elected governor. We had a divided legislature, and I knew we needed to work together, and actually worked closely, very well together. I think Dennis and Arnie Roebland and co-speaker Hannah and Peter Courtney were largely the reasons that we took what appeared to be just a toxic environment and actually made lemonade out of those lemons. So thank you for that.
Gentlemen, I appreciate you both ending here on a positive note. That does conclude our debate this morning. On behalf of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters and the voters in this great state, I want to thank both of you for being here and for everyone at home for watching, tuning in, and making an informed decision. I will remind everyone in the room and everyone watching or listening at home, the last day to register to vote is October 14th. Election day, of course, is Tuesday, November 4th. Your vote does indeed matter. Thank you so much for being with us today.
C-SPAN's 2015 Student Cam competition is underway. This nationwide competition for middle and high school students will award 150 prizes totaling $100,000. Create a 5 to 7 minute documentary on the topic, The Three Branches and You. Videos need to include C-SPAN programming, show varying points of view, and must be submitted by January 20th, 2015. Go to studentcam.org for more information. Grab a camera and get started today.
Coming up on C-SPAN, Microsoft founder Bill Gates talks about the response to the Ebola outbreak. Then Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the Syrian Deputy Prime Minister speak before the UN General Assembly. And later, Deputy Secretary of State William Burns talks about U.S. Middle East policy. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has donated $50 million to Ebola outbreak response efforts. Bill Gates spoke about Ebola Monday in Washington. He was interviewed as part of Politico's Lessons from Leaders series. This is an hour.
Mike, thank you so much. And Anne, a special thanks to you. We're delighted to be partnering with Bank of America and to kick off this series. I can't think of anyone better or more timely to have a conversation with than Bill Gates. We so appreciate you joining us this morning and to all of you who are here. We're going to start off with, it in a way, an unlikely but I think absolutely fitting topic, which is the subject of Ebola and the spreading crisis in Africa and potentially beyond Africa. The Gates Foundation recently announced that it is donating $50 million to help with the response. I think all of us think about what's happening with the disease and the spread of it, and we have to ask questions that really relate to leadership, right? Whether it's our global health institutions, whether it's individual countries and their ability or lack thereof to respond to it, whether the United States has a role, and whether it was too late and slow in mobilizing and thinking about the kind of leadership that would be required. So, Mr. Gates, obviously you've spent the last really more than a decade focused on global health challenges in Africa. Here comes a big crisis of exactly the sort that we've been worrying about and warning about. Where do you feel the role of individual leadership and global leadership comes into play in this crisis?
Well, I think Ebola is a great example of where the world really needs to come together. The three countries where this outbreak took place have had a lot of civil war, very weak health systems. Ebola had never shown up in West Africa before. And so it did take a while for people to understand, okay, we've got Ebola here. And even that eventually what we saw was a very unique Ebola epidemic. There have been over a dozen, and they've all been, you could say, like bushfires that with the right, a little bit of pressure, getting some medical workers in, getting people to not intermingle both with the people who have it while they're living or as they're burying the people who die from it. And yet here it got into a big city, and it is an incredible challenge. And everybody's now putting their resources in. Tom Frieden went over there personally, went and saw the head of the CDC, and he's the one who really said, no, this is a different Ebola epidemic. And now everybody's galvanizing to get behind this. I think it is quite impressive what's being pulled together. And I do think we'll be able to get this under control. We need to make sure that it doesn't spread out to other parts of Africa. That's a particular challenge, and then we need to get it under control in these three locations. And there's a pretty clear roadmap of what needs to be done. Our foundation's particularly involved in a few of the locations, like in Nigeria, because there's been a big investment in polio eradication. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea of having expertise in what are called emergency operations centers and how you orchestrate medical personnel, the polio resources and the polio lessons are very helpful here. In fact, the reason that it got stopped in two of the countries, Nigeria and Senegal, is because people from polio were pulled in, acted very quickly. Money from us and others was pulled in. So the next few months will be tense. Every day, you know, there's tons of email flying about how quickly can people get in, can we get the new tools. But there's an overall approach now, and you know, the U.S. is, as usual, on world problems, stepping up both in terms of the science, the understanding, and now the U.S. military's logistic ability to get supplies in and create field hospitals that are critical.
Mr. Gates, what an honor to have you here. And we had you great conversation last year at Bank of America's Playbook Cocktails. I'm sorry there's no booze this time. But you say that...
It is 8 in the morning.
It's 5 o'clock somewhere. You say that we're mobilizing now and we're going to get this under control. But David Nather has a great story up, the lead story of Politico this morning, the Ebola leadership gap, that points out how late everyone has been, the private sector, governments. Why did it get so far out of control?
Well, I suppose that's the easiest article to write. It's when there's a financial crisis or a... Well, unless you have an algorithm for predicting the future, all new surprising things, that article is great. I'm pretty impressed with how quickly people have stepped up on this. Ideally, you would have decent primary health care in all of Africa. It's far better today throughout Africa because of a variety of things, including PEPFAR money's gone in to build up systems. General USAID has gone in to build up systems. These three countries, partly because of civil war, have not gotten there. And so because Ebola was never seen in this area before, and because the primary health care system didn't report it, and because burial practice, the touching of the body, makes the disease spread far more forceful, it percolated long, in the May-June time frame, and only in July did you have an urban case. Then, in August, the numbers started to jump up. And that's when everybody said, okay, this is quite unique. We had done a grant in July. We did one in August. And we got the Nigeria thing organized. But you'd say it was mid to late August before the world saw this as a very unique Ebola crisis.
If you're Joe Moore, why should you care? What does it mean to the U.S. now and in coming years?
Well, the epidemics like this, it's far better to stop them before they spread to lots and lots of countries. And the tragedy here is both the Ebola deaths, but also the civil unrest. What happens when you have people panicking about an epidemic is that the entire health system shuts down. And so more people will die of malaria, pneumonia, diarrhea, not having hospital services for delivery. The death toll from this type of shutdown is because of a huge variety of diseases. And so we should all care a lot that not spread to lots and lots of locations. I mean, if the right thing hadn't been done in Nigeria to catch it in the bud, you'd have there, a city with 10 million people, and you'd have a complete disaster and lots of panic. So I think we should care about the people there and the economy's there. And the U.S., in fact, is the one who's got the CDC that can figure these things out, playing a central role. It's got the army that can go in there with the logistics and the medical understanding. All the new tools we're looking at in terms of vaccines and diagnostics, it's all stuff that the primary funder in general and of the particular things that look like they can be pulled together pretty quickly are all U.S. investment in innovation type things. So for me, this is one of the great causes, one of the two causes our foundation has picked is the health of everybody in the world, treating lives as having equal value, making sure that not only do you get rid of the death, but kids can grow up in a healthy way. To us, it's a very central thing. But the key actor is the United States and the investments that, in a bipartisan way, this country has stood behind for literally decades.
Can I ask you about institutions? You talked about the infrastructure that already existed on polio, thanks in part to the work that you've done, being able to swing over when there's a crisis and to respond. Obviously, not all of these countries have that infrastructure. How much, when you look at a crisis like this, do you see it as being one where you have to, in effect, pre-position your success? You need infrastructure, you need institutions that function versus politics. Where do politics come into play, both in successfully dealing with something like this or not, as the case may be?
Well, we'd like every country to be self-sufficient so that both in terms of running a good primary health care system and funding a good primary health care system, it's all okay. And they just participate in regional bodies that have standby capacity to deal with these things. Africa, of all the places in the world, is the furthest behind on being able to do that. And through aid, health and health systems in Africa have improved very, very dramatically. I mean, childhood death is down by over half in Africa as a whole between the year 2000 and now. And there's been an acceleration. The Economist just had a good piece on this, on the acceleration over the last 5 years as people got more focused on this as one of those measurable Millennium Development Goals. You know, I think there's probably about 20 years here where there'll be some countries in Africa that we need to help lift them up. The ongoing rate of bad health there is very high. Over 500,000 kids a year die of malaria. You know, Ebola isn't going to get to the level of something like a malaria or an HIV, because I do think we're stepping up and we'll respond. Those things, you know, through medical research, through generosity like PEPFAR, those things will also come under control. And that's how you'll be able to move all these African countries up to middle-income status. It won't happen overnight, but we can see slowly but surely Africa's no longer as much of an outlier as it was in the past.
Now, this is your first interview on Ebola since the outbreak, but you've been engaging Washington on global health for years, and people assume Washington's totally broken down, but it's your view that Washington actually has showed some leadership that the press hasn't really covered.
Well, the phenomenal generosity of the United States in its aid budget towards health issues is the best in the world. You can look at that broadly. You can look at it in terms of the HIV, the PEPFAR money, you know, which came together in a Republican administration with bipartisan support. It's been increased under this administration. Fortunately, it's one of the few things that there really is a strong consensus on, getting vaccines out to these kids. That's the Global Alliance for Vaccines, helping support polio eradication. There was actually a slight increase, $50 million a year, in the polio budget, which was fantastic. It allowed us to go to other countries and get lots more money and get enough money so that polio eradication can be completed. And whenever we get senators or congressmen to go out to Africa and see what's happened with malaria, that's President's Malaria Initiative, to see what PEPFAR has been able to do with health systems, you know, people come back very proud of the uplifting that's taking place there. And so it has been, there has been consensus, and the money's gone up as people have seen the success. And this is one of those very measurable things. This isn't they're in tough shape, we'll just shovel money over there and, you know, maybe something good will happen. In fact, in this case, you can follow the vaccines and you can follow the polio cases. In the case of Ebola, we won't be able to run the counterfactual of the U.S. not showing up, but I guarantee you it would be very, very different. It's, you know, that, you know, sitting there a few weeks ago saying, you know, will the president invoke all the resources of the U.S., which in fact he did, and I was thrilled with that.
Finally.
No, I wouldn't say finally. I mean, was there some other government who took decisive action before we did? You know, was the data really clear? Was there somebody whose CDC equivalent flew in and personally toured all these things? Is there someone else whose research is going to give us the vaccine that will be key to making sure this outbreak doesn't happen again? You know, the U.S. is the leader on being able to move into areas like this and help out. We have a lot of other countries that do step up in these things, the UK and France. But unless the U.S., actually that U.S. military logistic capability, being able to move as quickly as they do, getting people in and out, and being able even to say to medical workers, if you go in here, there will be an evacuation capability. That's why now the recruitment of medical workers worldwide is getting us to the level where we can get people to treatment centers. And that's, if you want to know what's going to help us win or lose on this, if the treatment centers are full and you're saying to people, hey, go back in your community, try not to touch anyone, then they'll move around, they'll infect lots more people. If the reputation of the treatment centers, that's where you go, there is capacity, it increases your chance of surviving, and if you die, somehow the way your body's dealt with will match with cultural practice. When we get there, this thing will start to drop. We're not there yet, but that U.S. capability, the polio resources that have been there to create the idea of these emergency operation centers. That's why I think we are going to get on top of this.
All right, that is the nicest thing I've heard about Washington in a long time. Susan?
Well, that was going to be my point. So Congress is at a historic low in its approval ratings. We didn't think it could go any lower, but it seems determined to set those kind of records. It's an election year. There might be consensus around certain aspects of global health, but in reality, support for foreign aid, as you know, and your team has thought a lot about how to change that. There's a diminishing zeal on the part of many Americans to remain engaged internationally. You know, how do you fight that? Number one, and number two, are there ways in which you found your goals to be frustrated by the gridlock here in Washington?
Well, the gridlock is very concerning. I think there's a lot of issues, immigration, increasing the energy R&D budget. There are some things that I think should be happening. I don't think our research, our investment in medical research should be allowed to tail off like it has been allowed to. So even in some of these great areas, it's a bit worrying. I don't think the term foreign aid is going to be easy to salvage. If people just think of that term, then all the money that we sent around in the Cold War to back our bad guy, where we didn't really pay any attention, we didn't measure any outcome from after we sent that check to Mobutu, you know, and to see did he build good palaces and was he having a good time, that's probably irredeemable. So talking about this aid in terms of the particular human things it does, that can be successful. And that's why getting as many Americans, not just politicians, but as many out to see this in action as we can, having them come back and tell the story, that's our best tool, is the truth about the reality of how tough things are and yet how much they're improving. And so, you know, over a quarter of the aid budget is global health related. Mm-hmm. AIDS, malaria, polio, basic health infrastructures. We're going to try and go, we're asking that there be a modest increase in the vaccine money out of that budget, as there's a new round of raising money for this Gavi that finances the vaccines for these very poor countries. You know, when you talk to people in those terms and you talk about, you know, literally saving lives for very small amounts of money and getting these countries on a path to self-sufficiency, then you see a strong response. But we have to tell that story, and it's got to compete with other budget priorities.
So we want to involve all of you in this conversation about lessons from leaders. So one of my Politico colleagues has microphones, so just signal if you have a question. We'll bring you in, Mr. Gates. Who are a couple of leaders who you admire, living or dead?
Well, there's leaders in science, people who really figure things out, like Richard Feynman, or people who work on vaccines, tons of people working on HIV vaccine. There's leaders in business, people like Warren Buffett, who've got, a certain approach they take that are pretty amazing. There's product innovators like Steve Jobs was, where he, gets behind a concept, does a fantastic job. There are people out in the field, whose names we won't know. There are, several hundred people who stayed in the Ebola-affected countries and continued to do the work, put themselves at great risk because medical workers are the most likely to be infected because they're helping out when the person's health is deteriorating, including quite a bit of bleeding as they're getting very, very sick. So there's many domains of heroes. I've gotten to work with some people like Warren Buffett, you know, I've sat and talked to, learned from. Nelson Mandela, I got to meet with a few times, talked to him while, you know, he was trying to get the AIDS crisis people to acknowledge it, step up and do the right thing. So, you know, it's pretty amazing this the great scientists or people in the field or leaders that I get to sit and talk with.
So to take Warren Buffett or Nelson Mandela, can you point to like specific traits that would help young people who want to be great leaders, great managers, great innovators?
Well, Mandela told people something they didn't expect to hear from him, which is that, you know, revenge and evening the score of how they'd been treated was not in their interest, and that even though in a certain way it was completely unjust, that the country had to move forward, it had to embrace everybody that lived there, it had to figure out how to have an economy that lifted everybody up. And you would not have predicted such a nonviolent transition of power. You know, literally the building that the government works in is the one where the most popular song that the ANC had was how they were going to blow up that building. Well, you know, Mandela worked in the building that he sang about blowing up literally hundreds of times. And, you know, so that's somebody getting you to step back and think, okay, we're all in this together in a way that without his presence, that just wouldn't have happened.
So as much as you've had this focus on institution building, that's what I wanted to ask you is about this question of where politics comes into play, both in a positive sense, like Mandela, but I'm thinking about your polio campaign and Pakistan in the last few years and, you know, the crisis that comes when politics defeats institutions or even investment in resources, persistence of ideology. What can you do about those challenges to your work?
Well, we definitely run in the polio campaign to a huge number of problems. You know, you've got terrorist groups that have kind of a nihilistic view towards medicine or vaccines that both in Nigeria and Pakistan, they've literally targeted polio vaccinators and gone out and killed them. And so the fact that people continue to volunteer to step out and get those vaccines out there is a truly amazing thing. We think we're very close to finishing on polio. We haven't had any violent events for the last 6 months. We do have unrest. Boko Haram up in Borno in Nigeria is a real problem. The army in Pakistan actually went in and cleared the area where kids weren't being vaccinated. And virtually all the cases in Pakistan, actually, literally the majority of all the cases in the world are in this one part of Pakistan called Waziristan. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that the army's cleared it actually means we'll have a bump up in cases as those kids move around. But it gives us a chance to get in and have access. So we're optimistic despite terrorist groups taking this on, which I wouldn't have expected. You know, why be against polio eradication? It seems wild that you'd pick that as something to be against. But we've had to put up with it, and yet the more the non-terrorist leaders have been our partners in trying to get the word out.
I think we have a microphone right here, and we have a question right here. And please introduce yourself.
Stella Dawson, Thomson Reuters Foundation. As you say, infrastructure is absolutely critical to getting this disease under control. You've been investing vast amounts of money in disease-specific campaigns. Are you rethinking how you're going to direct your funding in the future in order to help build more primary healthcare systems? And secondly, would you like to hazard a guess of when you think, given the resources that have been thrown at Ebola, it might be realistic to see it under control?
Well, I don't think you'll get anybody to predict a date. It's hard, given that it could spread out to other locations. You know, that's got to be a big concern. So getting all the surrounding countries to be ready so that if a few people show up there, there are treatment centers and people know that getting people into those treatment centers is the right thing for the patient and for the community. And so because of that uncertainty, I'm not going to hazard a guess. This month, the basic infrastructure in the three countries is going to get in place. The tent camps are going up fairly quickly. People are volunteering. So, you know, it's great to see the energy that the next, 30 days, those pieces will come into place. We do a lot on primary health care. Almost everything we do that we focus on, which is about saving mothers' lives and children's lives, is delivered through primary health care. And so the way that you train primary health care, the way you measure it, the way you compensate for it, that's a deep specialty of our foundation. And when you look at the outliers, usually health and income level are tightly correlated. As you get richer, you get less malnutrition, less of your kids die. There are countries like Ghana that are ahead of that. That is, less kids die by a lot than you'd expect given how poor they are. And there are some like Nigeria that are behind that. And so understanding how the good systems are built and bringing that to those other countries, that's been a huge area of focus for us. It's not so much the actual infrastructure, the buildings is not the hard part. It's training the workers, getting the supply chain, both of normal drugs and also the vaccines that require cold chain in. And, you know, we can go through country by country and talk about how we're engaged in raising those primary health care systems up. And if we'd had that, you know, this epidemic would have been caught a month or two before it actually was.
There's a strain of thought. We have a couple questions over here, so we'll grab one of those.
Yes, Betsy Williams with Seed Global Health. Just building on that point a little bit, I think something that's been lost is the gains that had really been made in these very fragile healthcare systems. And they've just come from a period of rebuilding with great leadership. And so my question is, what investments can we make in parallel to the Ebola response to restore those services and also ensure that the health system that exists after this is stronger and more resilient than the one that was in place?
Well, as I said, right in that region, you have Ghana, and actually it's Accra where they're setting up the UN Orchestration Center to try and look at this thing. Ghana is a positive outlier in terms of how they run the primary health care system. Ethiopia is a positive outlier. Rwanda is a positive outlier. And in fact, the amount of money that goes in to some of the poor systems, like the Nigerian system, is every bit as much as goes into some of the better systems. So understanding how you spend the money, how you track the activity in those systems, we understand that fairly well. If we can stop Ebola when it's just these three countries, you're talking about a population of about 22 million people in the three countries, building back up primary health care in those three countries should be fairly straightforward. And that'll be a very high priority. As I said, more kids, even in those three countries, will die because the health system is shut down than even will die from Ebola. And so if you hesitate even a few months to get it so mothers feel like, yes, I should go and do safe delivery, or I should go and get malaria medicines or antibiotics for pneumonia, that will be very tragic, even though it's not as explosive and therefore not as garnering the same type of attention that the Ebola deaths themselves attract.
I think Senator Dodd has a question.
Thank you, America, for doing this. You're a pretty good example of redefining philanthropy. So thank you.
So thank you for all you've done in redefining philanthropy. And can't think of a better example than you as an example of a leader that's made a difference in the world. First of all, thank you for your kind compliments about the Congress. You may be the only person in town. But just to add to your point, actually the House of Representatives increased the funding for PEPFAR in their budget. And Bob Corker told me the other day, Senator Corker, that the Senate will likely as well. So those doesn't get much notice, but those are things that are being done in a positive way. In the year 2000, as you pointed out already, the UN Millennium Goals were identified, the eight identified. And I'm wondering, looking at it from a management standpoint, and again, you sort of addressed this to some degree already, some of them are rather vague in a sense, all very worthwhile goals, but nonetheless, there's some vagueness to them. How do we score success in those areas, and what management techniques can be brought together? 179 nations signed on to that. And there is a tipping point, I think, in the U.S. in terms of what we can actually do and be successful at it. How do we draw other nations into this process beyond the French and the British and the European countries that do so to become much more aggressive and proactive in addressing some of these issues?
Yeah, that's a very timely question because those goals essentially, although they were put together in the year 2000, they covered sort of the 25-year period. The baseline was 1990 to 2015. And so we had 15 years for the world to really prioritize those activities. And the fact that they were very measurable, I mean, reduced childhood death by two-thirds, was absolutely incredible. And many countries met that. The world as a whole will have only reduced